Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the March 2024 EMED Home EM Cast. This is Amal Mattu at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Once again, welcome back. This month, we've got only two topics, but they are fantastic topics that we're going to spend a good deal of time discussing each. The first is a recent publication just from this past December from the American Heart Association, focused updates on CPR. There's some really, really important topics that they address in this update. And I've got two fantastically smart people, one of whom I work with, the other is from New Jersey. Mike Winters, who is my colleague here, and Lloyd Tannenbaum, who's done a number of different cardiac topics in recent months for the EM Cast. The two of them are teaming up to discuss this AHA update. And then one of my other super smart colleagues, Dr. David Gatz, who, again, you've heard before, is going to spend some time talking about a topic that he loves talking about, and that is pulmonary embolism. That's going to be based on a very, very nice article that was written up on pulmonary embolism for Annals of Emergency Medicine, and it brings us up to date on a lot of the recent literature on this topic. Before we jump in, once again, I just want to remind everybody about two really great upcoming conferences. On April 3rd, in the morning is going to be our ninth, I don't know what number it is now, but it's going to be our annual Emergency Cardiology Symposium. Check out the website ecs.umem.org. It's a free conference that you can attend virtually. You just have to register. And if you cannot attend live, then you can just register and get the recordings to listen to afterwards. It's going to be a really great conference on a handful of challenging conundrum type of topics in emergency cardiology. And then moving later into April is going to be our Beats and Bones conference. This is a combined cardiology and orthopedics conference. How in the world do these two topics relate? Well, cardiology is very common and high risk, and emergency orthopedics is also very common and fairly high risk also in terms of disasters that can happen. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Aaron Sayal from up in Toronto, actually, who, in my opinion, is the best educator in North America, maybe in the world, in emergency medicine, in emergency orthopedics. He and I are going to be teaming up to talk about some cardiac and orthopedic challenges. Day one is April 8th. Day two is April 10th. And you can check out the website for that conference at beatsandbones.com. That's beatsandbones.com. Check it out. All right, well, let's move forward and get on to the couple of topics for this month. All right, well, kicking things off this month, we're going to spend some time talking about not just a bread and butter topic, but an absolutely critical topic for all emergency physicians, and that is cardiac arrest. I think there's probably no topic in emergency medicine in which we as emergency physicians need to be the absolute experts. It's one of those things that we love addressing and taking care of patients in cardiac arrest. We don't hope for people to be in cardiac arrest, but gosh, I don't know of any other specialty that really looks forward to having the opportunity to resuscitate these patients the way we do. And so, at least from a personal standpoint, whenever I see something interesting coming out from AHA journals, like Circulation, it always gets me interested. And in December, late December, there were two really important articles that got published in Circulation from the AHA, which I think we definitely need to address. I don't think they're out in print yet, but they're online. One of them is one of the AHA-focused updates. It's 2023 American Heart Association focused update on adult advanced cardiac life support. And the other is an AHA scientific statement focused on cardiac catheterization laboratory management of the comatose adult patient with an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In other words, when the patient gets returned spontaneous circulation, which of those patients need to go for immediate cath? There's been a lot of questions around this and some new literature and some other topics in CPR and cardiac arrest that got some recent good literature. And I think that was the reason that AHA has published this focus update. So anyway, two articles, both of them are relatively long. So I definitely wanted to get some really, really smart colleagues to help with this. And I was successful. Joining us today are Drs. Mike Winters, who many of you've heard before. He's one of our critical care experts and lectures on cardiac arrest nationally and internationally. And also another person that you've heard multiple times, Dr. Lloyd Tenenbaum. Lloyd is one of the faculty at the Hackensack Medical Center and has a very strong interest in emergency cardiology. So Mike and Lloyd, thank you both for your time and welcome back to EMCast.
Thanks so much, Amal. It is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to have this discussion with Lloyd.
Yeah, thanks, Amal. I'm really excited to be here too. I'm excited to work with you, Mike.
All right. Well, there's a bunch of things to discuss. And so why don't we just go ahead and jump right in, and we'll focus probably on the AHA focused update. They first start by discussing vasopressor medications during cardiac arrest. Obviously, the main vasopressor is going to be epinephrine. And Mike, why are they talking about epinephrine again? Are there any new updates regarding these vasopressors that we need to know about?
Thanks, Amal. Starting off with the vasopressors, in general, I don't think there's anything brand new, but they continue to emphasize that epinephrine remains a class one, so recommended, a strong recommendation, supported by what they term as level of evidence from moderate quality RCTs, as this class one recommendation for administration for folks or patients with cardiac arrest. And in essence, that's based on the continued systematic reviews and meta-analyses that demonstrate something we've talked about before, that sure, vasopressors and epinephrine specifically increase ROSC rates and increase survival to hospital discharge. But they continue to emphasize that epinephrine has not been shown to result in meaningful increases in survival with favorable neurologic recovery. And they do cite two studies, one of which, as many of us are familiar with, the Paramedic 2 trial. Now, we've got a little bit more data since those publications that have continued to support 6 and 12 month outcomes in patients that got epi versus didn't. And those specific studies continue to demonstrate that epi still does not or has not been shown to increase long-term favorable neurologic survival. But notwithstanding, they continue to recommend epi as a class one. And in essence, reading through the document, they justify this by simply saying that, well, if it increases ROSC, it increases survival to hospital discharge, perhaps we need to focus on getting epi earlier to patients and then continuing that good post-cardiac arrest care. And perhaps that may then march through to more meaningful outcomes. I think that's the only thing I can really draw from that, Amal. But notwithstanding, epi remains class one because of increased ROSC rates and survival to hospital discharge. They also, it's a little bit weaker recommendation, so not a class one, but they stated that it is reasonable to continue to give epi 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. And then also as a slightly weaker recommendation based on limited data, recommend that in those that we're managing and treating with non-shockable rhythms, so PEA or asystole, focusing getting epi on board as soon as possible in comparison and contrast to those with shockable rhythms where we're going to prioritize defibrillation first.
Got it. I was going to ask you about the shockable versus non-shockable type of rhythms and the use of epi there, because they are slowly more and more in these publications that they put out, kind of making a little bit of a distinction between the non-shockable, where you want to get it on board as soon as possible, and the shockable ones, where it's a little bit of a quandary that persons in VFib, you kind of wonder, maybe they've got too much catecholamine on board, maybe electrical storm in some cases, and adding more adrenergic support is probably not the greatest thing. So I guess we'll see how more literature comes out.
I agree with that.
Yeah. They mentioned vasopressin also. Anything to add about vasopressin?
So in terms of vasopressin, they give this a weak recommendation to consider vasopressin alone or a combination of vasopressin plus methylprednisolone. They state that it can be considered in cardiac arrest. But I think the take-home message is it really doesn't offer any significant advantage or superiority to giving epinephrine. And in essence, what they state is essentially systematic reviews did not find any difference in outcomes in trials that have tested vasopressin alone or in combination with epi compared to simply epinephrine alone. They do make reference of a recent study that, Amal, I think we've reviewed in one of our critical care literature updates for the year, and that's the VAM IHCA trial. And that was a study published about a year and a half ago, looking at that whole combination, if you recall, vasopressin plus methylprednisolone after epinephrine. And that particular randomized trial in a little over 500 patients did show an increase in ROSC with that combination of vasopressin and methylprednisolone. But I think just like epinephrine, what we talked about is still this combination has not been shown to improve long-term survival with favorable neurologic outcomes. So a weak recommendation to consider it, but I think with looking at the evidence, my personal opinion is it's not something we really need to consider.
Excellent. I remember I had an attending when I was way back in residency who used to always tell us that you should never let someone die without a dose of magnesium and a dose of steroids. So it was based on no evidence at all. Whenever I see these studies with methylprednisolone and cardiac arrest, I always think of them. So anyway, Lloyd, let's get back to you now. They next talk about some of the non-vasopressor medications during cardiac arrest. What do we need to know here?
Yeah, Amal, that's a great question. So for the non-vasopressor medications, we usually reach for in cardiac arrest. You want to think about those antiarrhythmics like lidocaine or amiodarone, magnesium, sodium bicarb, glucose, calcium, and then steroids, they even mentioned here, ironically enough. So these drugs are attractive. They're often used in cardiac arrest. They're almost always in the code cart. They're easily accessible. But unfortunately, none of them have been proven to improve overall survival after cardiac arrest. Say that there's a little caveat here. In special populations, these medications can be life-saving treatments and should obviously be given, right? So if someone's glucose is very low, you're obviously going to give them dextrose. If you're worried about hyper-K, you would consider calcium, sodium bicarb. If there's a toxic overdose, you think about bicarb. In special populations like that, obviously you want to give that medication. But for just routine cardiac arrest where you're not suspecting any of those, these aren't really going to help you a whole ton. If we dive in a little bit deeper to this article, in 2018, amiodarone and lidocaine were reviewed, and their use showed an increase in survival to hospital admission, but it did not improve survival to discharge or survival with a good neurologic outcome, which are two of the main things we care about for these patients. Interestingly, there was a subset of patients who were given lidocaine or amiodarone and did have an increase in survival to hospital discharge, and those were patients who had a bystander witnessed arrest. So, in the paper, the authors suggest that maybe if given early, amio or lidocaine may be beneficial. There are a couple confounders there, of course. It could be that just noticing the arrest earlier, starting CPR, especially high quality CPR, and earlier transport to a center may be what's causing this benefit. They're not sure. So for right now, the AHA gives us a class 2B recommendation to consider lidocaine or amiodarone for VFib or pulseless VTAC that's unresponsive to defibrillation. So remember, with those rhythms, you want to defibrillate as soon as possible. But if it's unresponsive, you can consider these drugs. For steroids, that's an interesting one. Personally, I don't think I've given steroids to a code. Maybe I have and I don't remember it, but off the top of my head, I don't think so. I know we consider steroids in patients who are like unresponsive depressors, but if it's a full arrest, it's not really one of my go-tos. The data here is pretty uncertain too. They said that the only study suggesting a benefit looked at steroids being given with other medications, so it's hard to know exactly what was helping and what was just fluff. For right now, the AHA gives us a class 2B recommendation that steroids during a code shows an uncertain benefit. And the last three we can just lump together. Amal, earlier when we did the bicarb article, we mentioned that one, that you don't give bicarb routinely in an arrest unless you're worried about a special population. The same is true about calcium and magnesium. The routine administration of these meds shows no benefit. And again, remember that small caveat, there are some special populations, such as the overdose or hyper-K, where these meds can be helpful. But if it's just routine use for an undifferentiated arrest, that's a no for right now.
All right, great summary. And just to recap, class 2B is they list that as quote possibly helpful. Class 2A probably helpful. So if I recall my English classes, the word possible could be yes, it could be no. So it's really a real big hedge on their part when they say that. So anyway, Mike, there's been some recent literature on using ECMO in the ED for patients in cardiac arrest. And so the AHA felt it would be worth updating their protocol prior stance on ECMO. Where does the AHA now stand with regards to using ECMO for these patients?
Great question, Amal, and it's certainly been an area of interest over the last several years in terms of its focus. Well, you mentioned 2A and what that wording was. Well, they give the use of ECPR a 2A recommendation, so could be useful. Reasonable is the other term that they use in patients with cardiac arrest that are refractory to standard ACLS, thinking about that. But importantly, they make the caveat that considered or maybe reasonable where patients are provided with this intense therapy in appropriately trained and appropriately equipped systems. And I think that's an important distinction. I'm not going to do a deep dive into these articles, but I think there's three articles to be aware of in the last several years that have looked at ECPR. Many are familiar with the ARREST trial. That was that single center trial in the upper Midwest that essentially showed improved survival to discharge and 6 month survival for those that got randomized to go right up to the cath lab, be placed on ECMO, get cardiac cath. And that really was shown to be most beneficial for those with a shockable rhythm. The second is the Prague out of hospital cardiac arrest trial. And while that didn't meet its primary endpoint from a statistical significance, it did trend towards benefit in those receiving ECMO. And then most recently is the Inception trial, whereby this was a multi-center trial looking at ECPR across 10 centers. And while that didn't find a difference in ECPR versus standard ACLS, I think one of the bigger criticisms of that particular study is that many of those centers actually were just getting going with their ECPR programs. And I think that's now tying back to the AHA update with respect to its recommendation on considering this therapy in appropriately trained and appropriately equipped systems of care. Now, for you and I, we are an ECMO center, and we do ECPR from time to time in the emergency department, in our emergency department. And quite honestly, as you know, Amal, it essentially brings the ED to a halt because lots of folks, lots of resources are needed and brought to the bedside of that patient. In fact, a case that we did last week, our chair was working a shift in the department, happened to be his patient. And as he took a step back and counted, well, there was actually 27 people in and around this particular case.
Wow.
And I think probably the more important thing is, well, who should we consider for this? And I think the take-home message is we don't really know at this point. We've got good information, but there are no standard universally accepted criteria for the patient who should receive ECPR. As a general rule, as a general indication, patients less than 70, some centers have less than 60, but those a little bit younger in age that lack significant comorbidities, that have a good neurologic status prior to their arrest, where it's a witness arrest, bystander CPR applied, a short downtime, a short transport time to an ECMO center, and then overall a relatively shorter time to cannulation in the setting of a shockable rhythm. Those tend to be the most favorable characteristics for deciding someone to put on ECPR. A few other indications would be the tox cardiac arrest and potentially the massive PE. But that's in essence what we're looking at, a younger cohort, a little bit on the more on the healthier side, short downtime, witnessed arrest, shockable rhythm, and short transport time and short cannulation time.
All right, well, that's definitely a very select population. And they use that term select population. So we're really talking about the 25-year-old healthy person who has a cardiac arrest due to a massive PE in the waiting room. Almost. So it's
Well, it depends. Sometimes that waiting room length of stay at some facilities could prevent them. But nonetheless, yeah, it's those criteria are evolving. And once again, there's no universally accepted criteria. And if you are at a place that's considering initiation of an ECPR program or ECMO program, it is critical to have a multidisciplinary approach and mutually agreed upon indications for your center. Because really, when you're receiving that pre-hospital call about the incoming arrest, that's the time to really activate your ECPR team because it just takes time to deploy everything, including the pump, to the emergency department. So having a well-established system and process is key to having a good outcome when placing patients on ECMO.
Great, great. All right. Well, moving forward, probably if there's anything that I would describe as the 800-pound gorilla in this paper, and with regards to recent literature on cardiac arrest, it has to do with the indications for post-return of spontaneous circulation cardiac cath. Who is it that you resuscitate and then send to the cath lab immediately? Now, articles first started getting published probably back around 2010, and every year there's multiple articles that were coming out, and they consistently said that the post-arrest EKG is not reliable, and it always hurts my heart a little bit to say that about EKGs, but it wasn't reliable at predicting whether somebody had a coronary occlusion. And so authors of many of these papers from the critical care and the cardiology and EM literature altogether would say, just send everybody to the cath lab post-arrest. And it caused a lot of problems and a lot of controversy. Well, finally, some recent randomized studies have been published that have, I think, clarified the question quite a bit. So let's turn back to you, Lloyd. With these recent publications, what does the AHA now recommend regarding which post-arrest patients should go to the cath lab for consideration of possible PCI?
All right, so like you said, before it was like cath everyone, like we can't trust anything. We're just going to take them all to the cath lab. That'll tell us the answer. And now with this position, they've kind of changed that a little bit to like don't cath everyone, sort of. And we'll clarify that in a minute. But expect some crazy times ahead as we sort through what we should do with these patients. The AHA made this change to the not cathing model based on several recent randomized control trials that were performed in the last few years. If there's one takeaway from the article that I want to quote, it's when the article says, these studies demonstrate that there is no benefit to emergency coronary angiography over delayed coronary angiography for stable patients resuscitated from cardiac arrest without ST segment elevation, which is a huge culture shift. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Let's start with patients who should go to the cath lab based on their EKG, and then I'll turn it back over to you and Mike for some other patients to consider getting to that lab. So let's just start with the basics, and then we'll dive in a little bit deeper. The AHA recommends that all patients should go to the cath lab if their arrest was suspectedly due to a cardiac cause and there's ST segment elevation seen on the EKG, and that's a class one recommendation, as strong as they get. The other recommendation I want to hit briefly, and Mike may touch on this one too, which is I think good that we might hit it twice, is the last recommendation in this section that says emergency coronary angiography is not recommended over a delayed or selective strategy in patients with ROSC after cardiac arrest in the absence of ST segment elevation, shock, electrical instability, signs of significant myocardial damage, or ongoing ischemia. And that's a class three recommendation, which means the AHA is recommending against something. And in this case, it's taking these patients emergently to the cath lab. So they concluded this because, again, multiple RCTs have shown no benefit of emergent cath over delayed cath to patients not showing those ST segment changes, shock, electrical instability, signs of significant myocardial damage, or ongoing ischemia. So let's dive in a little bit. We're going to use that second article that you mentioned, Amal, to talk about it too. So I think most of this do this pretty automatically, but just remember, please get a post-ROSC EKG. They can be very helpful and help determine disposition. But something that I didn't know that I learned from these articles is that the test can be important, but it can also lead you astray, which we touched on earlier, is just kind of heartbreaking to me. EKGs performed post-ROSC can be misleading, showing a false positive abnormality. So think it meets STEMI criteria with ST segment elevations, and they were present in about 18.5% of EKGs performed within minutes of ROSC, 7.6% of those performed within 8 to 33 minutes of ROSC, and 5.8% in those over 33 minutes of ROSC. The later you get after ROSC, the less misleading the EKG can be. But for right now, the sooner you get the EKG, you should be aware there's a chance that it may be misleading you. Remember, you just brought this person back from the dead, so you can expect some electrolyte abnormalities like hyper-K. You can then also expect acidosis. And we know that these cause EKG changes that can mimic ischemia, so that may be the confounder here. The authors conclude that you should talk to the interventionalist and the intensivist about any concerning EKG that you have. And if there's ambiguity, consider getting serial EKGs to see if anything's changing. Ideally, you'll be able to get another EKG about 30 minutes or later after ROSC, because that's when the ambiguity is the least. However, if the patient's unstable, sometimes you just have to go with what you have and find out in the cath lab if it's true or not. But let's say there is ST segment elevation on the EKG and you have ROSC. Like, now what do you do? These patients need the cath lab. Several studies have shown that over 80% of patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with ST elevation on their EKGs have an acutely occluded vessel. This article makes a nod to the AHA guidelines by noting that there's a class one recommendation to take any patient with ST segment elevation on the EKG to the cath lab post-arrest. They note here that comatose patients have a much worse outcome than awake patients. They even go further to question the benefit of invasive therapies for patients with an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with ST segment elevation on the EKG and multiple features strongly associated with adverse neurological outcomes. Currently, the recommendation is to take anyone to the cath lab post-arrest with ST segment elevation on the EKG, but the authors recommend an honest, in-depth conversation with the patient's family about likely outcomes and possible futility, and consideration of transfer to comfort care to avoid the discomfort of further likely non-beneficial invasive medical procedures, which I think is important. In the world that we live in, there's so many tests that we can do, but I think we're shifting the culture a little bit to, we can do this, but should we do this? Is it what's right for the patient? Which is why I think they're recommending you have this conversation to let the patient's family know what the patient's in for. And even if we can do it, it may not bring us a lot of benefit.
Oh, that's a really, really great summary. So we're really pushing more towards ST segment elevation. And I think that the points that you brought up about the reliability of the EKG are really important. And I don't think people really think about that or know that. But you're right. Right after a patient gets their pulses back, their EKG is going to be influenced by the defibrillations and by all the epinephrine that's swirling around in their system. And there's going to be a lot of false positive ischemic looking EKGs. And so there's other literature that also suggests relying on a post-ROSC EKG that's done maybe 10, 15, or even longer minutes after the EKG and making a decision based on that. But you don't really want to just sit around and wait. So it does become a bit of a question about what to do. Lloyd, do you normally just use that first EKG immediately in the first 5 minutes after ROSC and then run with that? Or are you routinely holding off and getting a 30-minute EKG and using that?
I mean, I think it depends on how stable the patient is. If I can wait, I will try because, like you said, it can be a rapidly changing EKG. If there's ST segment elevation and it looks pretty consistent with it, I'll at least talk to the cardiologist. And then, it's kind of a collaboration with your colleagues of, hey, this looks bad. And the patient just got back from, just got ROSC. Maybe we should consider the cath lab. And, as long as you approach it with the interventionalist and you're trying to make a decision together, I don't think you can go wrong.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. All right. So if the post-arrest patient has ST elevation, we're calling for cath. And if the patient has no ST elevation, that makes us think of a STEMI, then we don't need to activate the cath lab, but instead, we'll probably just admit the patient to the ICU for focused resuscitation. And then the inpatient docs and cardiologists can continue to decide whether the patient should get a delayed cath a day or 2 or 3 days later. And that sounds pretty simple. But unfortunately, the HA paper and the scientific statement didn't actually make it that simple because then they also added some recommendations that there might be some other patients besides the ST elevation patients that should also go for immediate cath. So, Mike, what are they saying?
So that's a great question, Amal. And I'm going to say that Lloyd did a fantastic job describing that just the last few minutes in terms of additional indications. And what they state is those that have post-arrest evidence of cardiogenic shock, electrical instability, or hemodynamic instability, along with evidence of persistent myocardial damage, to consider early or immediate cardiac cath lab activation in those patients. And so the question becomes, well, that seems like every post-arrest patient, for that matter. And I think that the studies that Lloyd went over that you referenced, I think between COACT, Tomahawk, the EMERGE trial, that I think as a general finding, there wasn't an outcome difference with immediate versus delayed cath. But I do still feel that there's benefit in where you have a concern that there's a cardiac etiology, and we don't necessarily need to go through all of the preceding symptoms that led up to the arrest and then afterwards with the EKGs that you all just discussed. If there's a high enough suspicion, I still have the conversation. If there's a lot of ectopy on the monitor from a ventricular standpoint, if I'm titrating pressors and there's comorbidities and a history that would suggest that this may be more likely than not to be cardiac etiology, then I'm still going to have that discussion with the interventionalist. Now, with respect to the timing of EKGs, I'm exactly aligned with what you, the two of you just talked about, understanding that the EKG may be adversely affected in that first 10 to 15 minutes. I'm getting it. And if it is very concerning, I still end up actually having that conversation because it takes time. If it's after hours, it takes time to mobilize the cardiac cath lab, get those folks headed in. And usually, following the conversation, following the consult with the interventionalist, that's a time frame when I can then repeat it. And if things are resolving, improving, and we decide to stand down, that's easier than waiting 30 minutes, potentially delaying where it may be beneficial for that patient, and then activating and having folks come in. Now, if it's during the daytime when all of the cath lab is there, in general, I'll have the conversation and someone from the cath lab will come down. We'll discuss it at the bedside. We'll, at that point, we'll once again have enough minutes that have elapsed to repeat that EKG and collaboratively decide. So I still find that I'm having that conversation more frequently and not taking necessarily a dogmatic approach that non-STEMI, let's just admit to the ICU. I still think that there are these other indications whereby we should be thinking about it, having that conversation. And once again, those are evidence of ongoing cardiogenic shock, electrical or hemodynamic instability, and then evidence of ongoing myocardial damage.
Oh, that's a great approach. Makes a lot of sense. All right, now let's change gears and talk about cooling patients post-arrest. This used to be called therapeutic hypothermia, then they changed the name to targeted temperature management, and now apparently they're calling it temperature control. So, Lloyd, aside from the name change, is there anything else that's changed?
Well, Amal, again, great question. There is a shift to temperature control now instead of targeted temperature management. Temperature control covers a couple different topics. There's the hypothermic temperature control, normal thermic temperature control, and temperature control with fever prevention. Lots of trials looked at in this recommendation. And the big takeaway here is that in 2021, this is a long name, so bear with me, the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation Consensus on Science with Treatment Recommendations. It was a long one to get through. Updated their recommendations to include two key trials, which found no outcome difference after temperature management of 32 to 34 degrees compared with normothermia, which is it's just surprising because it was such a shift to cool these patients as soon as possible, and now it's almost no difference. So let's dive in a little bit. These guidelines recommend that all adults who do not follow commands after ROSC receive treatment that includes a deliberate strategy for temperature management. That's a level one recommendation. So they're saying that your hospital should have a plan with what to do. They're not necessarily telling you what the plan is, but you should have a plan. So if we look a little further and say, what should that temperature be? There was a very large trial called the TTM2 that found no difference in outcomes between patients treated with a target temperature of 33 degrees and 37.5 degrees Celsius. So the AHA recommends selecting and maintaining a temperature between that range, and that's also a class one recommendation. Length of time for temperature management also remains unknown. There's a large trial currently underway that's looking at the optimal time spent cooling or with temperature management. Currently, the AHA recommends at least 24 hours of targeted temperature management, with the caveat that new data may emerge and change this rec. We're looking at is it 24, 48, longer, shorter, somewhere in the middle. But they're saying at least 24 hours right now, and that's a class 2A. Does it matter if the patient had a shockable rhythm or was in PEA? Not at this time. There's insufficient evidence to recommend a specific therapeutic temperature for a different subgroup of cardiac arrest patients, and that's class 2B. All right, so that's should we cool them or not? Now, what if their temperature goes up? What if they have a fever? Well, it was noted in the 2020 guidelines that a fever after ROSC is associated with poor outcomes in patients not being treated with temperature management. The AHA recommends that it may be reasonable to give medications to prevent a fever after the initial temperature control, and that's class 2B. So now what do we do if the patient is too cold? So remember, the goal temperature should be somewhere between maybe 33 to 37. What do you do if they're 30 degrees? What if you do if they're colder than that? Do we rewarm them? Do we rewarm them quickly? And what's the target temperature that we should be shooting for? So you're going to shoot to cool them at a rate between 0.25 and 0.5 degrees Celsius per hour. And just be aware that some patients will need to be rewarmed a little bit faster. So examples of patients that should be rewarmed quickly would be those with severe trauma and blood loss. They should be getting warm blood instead of cold blood. And remember, anybody with severe hypothermia, that where it's, there's bradycardia and hemodynamic instability or ectopy on the monitor, these should be warmed more quickly than 0.25 to 0.5 degrees per hour.
Got it. Okay. So hopefully our boarding is not so terrible that we're going to be in the process of warming them up a day later, but you never know. So it is always useful to know these recommendations. So generally 24 hours of cooling, and then they can start warming back up. All right, Mike, the last thing I think we'll talk about from this paper is seizures. And quite honestly, this isn't really something I typically think about in the post-arrest comatose or unconscious patient. And so it was surprising to see this, and it kind of made me feel, well, why haven't I been thinking about it? So what does the AHA want us to know about seizure activity in these patients?
Once again, another great question, Amal. And I think it's something, from my perspective, that I've seen emphasized a little bit more emphatically over the last several years, especially with the latest iteration of the AHA guidelines along with this update. And I think an alarming potential stat is that in patients who aren't following commands after ROSC, actually seizure activity may be occurring in anywhere from 10 to 35% of patients. And that's a pretty high statistic or high incidence of seizure activity. And I think all of us can get on board with, if there is seizure activity, that neuronal hyperexcitability, well, that can exacerbate secondary brain injury and ultimately lead potentially to worse neurologic outcome and worse outcome for the post-arrest patient. So the AHA absolutely recommends, it's one of, you know, of all these recommendations in the latest guidelines, and more specifically with these updates, class one recommendation to promptly perform an EEG for patients who remain comatose following ROSC for the detection of seizures. And if you detect seizures, to promptly treat them, once again, as a class one recommendation. Now, specifically, if we just look at all of the evidence, there's actually no randomized trials, that there are no direct evidence to say that EEGs to detect seizures, to detect non-convulsive status epilepticus, actually does improve outcomes. We're extrapolating that from that seizures may worsen brain injury. But I think that that makes sense. Having said that, if we detect seizure activity, we would treat that with our standard anti-epileptic medications, nothing special in the post-arrest patient, use the same medications as you would. They do not really get into or elaborate a specific timing on when that EEG should be performed, or actually the method. So some are continuous, some are limited EEGs. It's really left up, I think, to the resources that you have at hand, and they do not make any firm recommendations one way or the other, other than consider seizure activity. It occurs actually probably more frequently than we would anticipate. Work with our colleagues within our resource settings to try and get an EEG as soon as possible. If it detects seizure activity, we would aggressively treat that. So I think one of the other questions is, well, if we don't have the resources, we know seizure activity occurs fairly common in unresponsive or patients that don't follow commands after ROSC. If I can't get an EEG, I'm just going to give an anti-epileptic medication. They do actually make a class three, so no benefit, potentially harmful, recommendation on prophylaxing every patient with ROSC following cardiac arrest. They don't recommend that. More so just thinking about seizure activity, try your best to get an EEG. If you detect it, treat it aggressively. And they do make a nod, once again, for non-convulsive status epilepticus. That's a little bit harder to determine if there is any type of benefit from a patient-centered outcome standpoint. But similar to overt seizures, we would still want to treat those similar to any non-post-arrest patient.
All right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And was a very nice summary of that. I got to start thinking about that a little bit more. And again, this idea of promptly getting an EEG may not be all that reasonable in a busy emergency department, especially at nighttime, but at least it's worth thinking about. And in those boarding patients, it might be appropriate for us to go ahead and get that started. All right. Well, that was a really great discussion of two very dense papers, a lot of content in these papers. And just as a wrap up, how about if I ask each of you to just leave our listeners with a couple of your top take-home points? Lloyd, you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, no, I'd love to. And Mike, that was really interesting about the antiepileptic drugs. I appreciate it. I didn't know that. So, that's a really good thing for me to take home. What I'd like to leave the listeners with is not all ROS patients need to be rushed to the cath lab. That's really my big take home from this paper. And that's the big culture change that the AHA is putting out. So remember, if you're concerned for cardiac cause, cardiac arrest, and you see ST segment elevation on the EKG, these are the ones that you should be sending. Remember, you can't always trust the EKG post-ROS. Ideally, you will have a little bit of time to either get a serial EKG or just repeat it and see if anything's changing or stretch it out to about 30 minutes. But, these patients are unstable and life happens. So if you're concerned, have a conversation with the interventionalist and the intensivist and figure out what the team thinks is the right plan for the patient. And then most importantly, remember, before taking someone to cath, if there's a lot of negative predictive indicators about the chance of this person waking up and having a neuro intact recovery, I'd recommend having an honest conversation with the family about outcomes and then help them make an informed decision so that you can respect what the patient would want in this situation.
Excellent. Mike?
Well, once again, Amo, I'd like to thank you and Lloyd for the opportunity to record this EM cast with you. It's been great fun. I think in terms of my take-home points, while epinephrine remains a class one recommendation, I think for me, it's important for all of us to remember that there still remains no literature on vasopressors and even the non-vasopressor medications that have demonstrated improved long-term survival with favorable neurologic outcome. While it is a class one, just I think it's important to remember that from an epinephrine standpoint. And it really gets back to, from a cardiac arrest standpoint, focusing on probably the most important intervention, high quality CPR, early defibrillation. With respect to ECPR, we're still learning more and more about ECPR. Currently remains a reasonable recommendation in programs or in resource settings or in systems that have experience with ECMO and have a well-defined process while we continue to identify who would be the best candidates for improved survival with ECPR. And then lastly, with seizures, think about it. I think that's the big thing in terms of when we have patients that remain comatose following ROSC, maybe up to one-third have evidence of seizure activity. Engage your perhaps neurocritical care, your critical care, or your neurology colleagues, and as best you can, work to get a timely EEG. If it's done in the emergency department, if it demonstrates activity, treat it with your tried and true, the antiepileptic drugs you're familiar with in terms of managing seizing patients.
Outstanding. Well, Dr. Lloyd Tannenbaum, Dr. Mike Winters, I am not worthy. So thank you. Thank you so much for spending time with me and with all of our listeners, enlightening us with these two, I think, very important AHA documents. And I certainly hope to get you guys back on the EM cast as soon as possible. So thanks again so much for your time.
Thanks, Amal. It was great working with you, Mike.
Thanks, Amal and Lloyd, as well. Awesome to have this discussion with the two of you.
All right, well, welcome back. We are now going to spend some time talking about a really, really nice paper that was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in September 2023. At least I thought it was a nice paper. We're going to find out from our guest commentator whether he agrees or not. But anyway, this paper was on managing pulmonary embolism. First author was Lauren Westafer. And again, published in September 2023, a very nice review article that actually went beyond just managing, but also a little bit about diagnosing PE as well. And I know that we've talked about PE a number of times, but it's been quite some time since we've talked about PE. And this was a really nice paper to bring together all of the most recent literature. Joining me to walk our way through the key points in this paper, one of my colleagues who's been on the EM cast a handful of times, Dr. David Gatz. David, welcome back to the EM cast.
Hello, hello. Wonderful to be back.
Now it's interesting you're here talking about PE now, because every time we talk about something, it seems to be something different.
Sadly.
It was transplant, and then you've talked about dissection, you've talked about med mal, and now PE, and you love everything. And more than that, you really know a lot about all of these different topics. In David has the distinguished role of being an assistant medical director in our emergency department, which means he gets tons and tons of positive feedback from everybody. And he loves looking through charts and solving all the problems that come up. Would you agree with that, David?
So much. It's a dream.
Right. Well, this is a, I think it's a nice paper. And I think you had said that you liked the paper also, but David does a lot of reading and talking and lecturing about PE. In fact, he just recently did a fantastic literature update on PE for Journal Feed. And so I couldn't think of anyone better to talk about this particular topic. So anyway, let's go ahead and jump in. And first of all, I alluded to this already that the title of the article is Management of PE. But before we start managing, we need to know how to diagnose these patients. And that begins with risk stratification. And the authors did go into this a bit. Can you talk to us, first of all, about why this concept of risk stratification is so important? And what exactly are we risk stratifying patients to?
Absolutely. And even the term risk stratification can be confusing here because it gets used over and over and over. From a diagnostic standpoint, risk stratification is going to refer to the probability of your patient having a pulmonary embolism. Is there a low versus intermediate versus high probability of having a PE? And because these numbers often get glossed over, I think it is important to recognize when we're talking low probability here, we mean there's a less than 15% chance of having a PE. So low, yes, but not zero. Intermediate probability, we're seeing about 15 to 49% risk, and high probability is thought of for patients having a greater than 50% risk that they have a PE. Now, risk stratification is a term also applied to the risk of mortality. The old terms that I think most listeners are familiar with would be a so-called submassive PE and massive PE. Massive PEs are those with hemodynamic instability. Submassive PEs are those that, while there is not hemodynamic instability, there is evidence of right heart strain. Now, there are two major issues with these old terms. Number one, they're confusing. And I have seen experienced EM physicians use them incorrectly, even in the literature. The word massive is usually associated in our mind with size, but the size or location of a clot does not automatically correlate with its hemodynamic effects. So, for example, I could have a very large saddle pulmonary embolism in an otherwise healthy young patient that is compensating well and therefore is not having any hemodynamic instability. By contrast, I could have, say, a bunch of segmental clots in a vulnerable patient, maybe an older adult with pulmonary hypertension at baseline. And perhaps those segmental clots are enough to cause hypotension. That's issue number one with this. Issue number two is that our submassive category is really quite broad, right? Do I have a slight troponin leak from my PE, or do I have both an elevated troponin and RV dysfunction? The term submassive fails to make any distinction here. So I would encourage everyone to scratch those terms out of your vocabulary. Instead, we are going to use what is broken down in actually figure three of this article. And to summarize it, we initially break the risk of mortality down into three categories: low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk, which is, fine, simple enough. The criteria for these are what we've already been discussing. High risk incorporates hemodynamic instability. Intermediate risk incorporates right heart strain, either by RV dysfunction or elevated troponin. And low risk PEs do not have hemodynamic stability or RV dysfunction or troponin leak. Now, things get a little more nuanced in that the intermediate risk category gets further broken down into what is called intermediate high and intermediate low. The distinction here is that the intermediate low risk patients have either RV dysfunction or elevated cardiac troponin, while intermediate high risk patients have both RV dysfunction and an elevated cardiac troponin. And I'll pause here because I would totally understand if some listeners are questioning, like, really, how much does this distinction actually matter? And I'm sure we'll dive into this later, but ultimately, it comes down to the fact that these two groups that we had previously tried to lump all together under submassive, they have different mortality rates. And so for our intermediate high-risk patients, that increased mortality risk means we are going to potentially offer them additional advanced therapies that we otherwise wouldn't think about because we're taking that in that increased mortality risk into account when we think about their risk-benefit ratio.
Got it. All right. So we've gotten rid of massive and submassive because people finally realize that size doesn't matter. And now it's really categorized into low, intermediate high, and high. And that's largely based on right ventricular dysfunction and some other parameters that I think that we will get into a little bit more. And, you know, it's important to me, at least, that we have risk stratification tools, because when we talk about low, intermediate, and high based on the likelihood, you know, low being less than 15% likelihood of a PE, intermediate 15 to 49%, high over 50%. I don't know how you can gestalt those numbers. I mean, there's patients that I take care of that I would say, well, I think this person's got a 10% chance. And somebody else would come in and say, I think this person's got a 30% chance. So it's really difficult to gestalt that. And I think because of that, we've got some really nice risk stratification tools like the PERC and the Wells and Revised Geneva and so on. But talk to us a little bit about how the authors suggest that we should use these tools to do risk stratification and then decide on the workup.
Yeah, kind of as you alluded to, right? This can be difficult. And providers, you know, sometimes hear words like pretest probability and risk stratification and often want to run the other direction. And I get it. But at the end of the day, this is a really important topic and simultaneously can also be really confusing, you know, especially if you've been following the literature, it can feel like a new pathway is coming out every other year or so. Now, the first question, which you kind of already hinted at, Amal, there is whether to use a risk stratification tool at all, or can we just rely on our clinical gestalt? And the authors suggest that we should preferentially use a risk stratification tool. And I agree. I'm not here to rain on anyone's parade. I'm sure we are all excellent clinicians. But while the sensitivity of our clinical gestalt is reasonable, our specificity is not. And this can lead to a lot of patients unnecessarily getting CT scans. So if you are not using a risk stratification tool, it's time to change your practice. Now, the authors put forth one possible diagnostic algorithm for non-pregnant patients, summarized in figure one of this article, which does a nice job, I think, not just summarizing, but also capturing the complexity of this topic. So step one here is just to determine, as we've mentioned a couple times already, what is the probability of your patient having a PE? Now, the authors propose using the Wells score, which is totally reasonable. I will note that at our own institution, we use the modified Geneva criteria. Both work. I think for us, the Geneva criteria are preferred just because they are entirely objective, whereas the Wells score does assign a significant number of points to whether the provider thinks PE is the most or equally likely diagnosis. Now, regardless of which one you use, it's going to categorize your patient, as we've been mentioning, as either low, intermediate, or high probability of pulmonary embolism. If your patient has a high probability of PE, the next step is pretty simple, and get a CTA. If your patient has an intermediate probability, then you should get a D-dimer. A negative D-dimer in an intermediate or low-risk population safely excludes PE. Done. If your patient has a low probability, then before jumping to that dimer, you should attempt to apply the PE rule-out criteria, or PERC, as many of us refer to it. I suspect most listeners have the criteria memorized by this point, but if not, it is easy to look up on MDCalc or Google or anywhere else. The major point here being that if your patient satisfies all of those criteria for PERC, no further evaluation for PE is indicated. Now, if any of those factors do apply to your patient, then you would need to proceed with D-dimer testing. And that's where things get really interesting, where a lot of the research is at. The question being, what D-dimer value counts as negative? There have been a number of major studies in the past decade, all aimed at increasing our D-dimer threshold, thereby allowing a greater proportion of our patients to avoid CT. The authors of this review include the YEARS algorithm, appropriately noting that it has the most robust evidence behind it. The purpose of the YEARS algorithm, as we've kind of been hinting at here, is to allow a higher D-dimer threshold, in this case up to 1,000 nanograms per milliliter instead of the traditional 500, so long as the patient does not have hemoptysis, does not have signs or symptoms of DVT, and so long as we, the provider, do not suspect PE to be the most likely diagnosis. And so just to emphasize that, right, the reverse of that would mean that for any patient that you're evaluating under YEARS that does happen to have either hemoptysis or clinical signs or symptoms of DVT or where you think PE is the most likely diagnosis, you would be stuck with a traditional D-dimer threshold of 500 nanograms per milliliter. Now, my commentary here would be that this is not really the original way the YEARS algorithm was envisioned. It was meant to be a standalone process for all comers with suspected acute pulmonary embolism, provided they're not anticoagulated or critically ill. That being said, I have no issue with how the authors have placed it inside their own proposed process within this figure. As I mentioned, you know, at our own institution, we use the Geneva criteria, and we combine that with an age-adjusted D-dimer threshold. The purpose is similar to what's been proposed here in Figure 1, which is, again, just trying to find higher D-dimer values and avoid unnecessary CT scans.
Right. That's a great summary of that Figure 1. For people that can access the article, Figure 1 has a nice algorithm, and I will tell you honestly, the Figure 1, although it's a nice algorithm, it does make it look a bit more complicated than it has to be. And just to recap, the most important thing is to start out with risk stratification. And we, just like David is saying, we like using the revised Geneva criteria rather than Wells, because we've got students, we've got residents, we've got all kinds of providers, and everybody's going to have a different subjective judgment and experience with PE. So the revised Geneva criteria is really nice because it's completely objective. And so everybody comes up with the same score. Whereas with Wells, you can come up with seven different scores, exaggerating. But
Or they should come up with the same score. The iterator reliability would be an interesting study in and of itself.
And Wells has been compared versus revised Geneva in studies, and they are identical. In fact, revised Geneva came out just a little bit better. But for all intents and purposes, they're pretty much identical. And then the one other point that I would make is the reason that we're not big fans of Gestalt, and some people out there are, but Gestalt in some studies is pretty good, but you have to wonder, whose Gestalt is it? Is it somebody who has been practicing for 25 years and has seen hundreds of PEs, or is it somebody who's just out of residency practicing for 25 days and has seen just a handful of PEs? Yeah. So Gestalt can really vary quite a bit. And that's why we at our university setting with all kinds of providers don't like using Gestalt. But there is data supporting that. And we do like using the age-adjusted D-dimer. Now, David, one of the things that really complicates things in terms of the use of D-dimer and the whole workup really is when a patient is pregnant, or maybe just postpartum. How does risk stratification change for these patients in your practice or based on the article? Give us a little bit of light here.
Pregnancy. Yes, I really appreciate the authors covered this actually pretty concisely in Figure 2 of their paper, and they do a great job with it. They show kind of their algorithm and approach, which is fairly standardized and accepted. And you know, this algorithm can also be found on resources like MDCalc. But for the pregnant patient with a suspected pulmonary embolism, you actually start by assessing first for signs or symptoms of DVT. If there is concern for DVT, we would proceed with a DVT ultrasound, which is obviously no risk for the fetus. That's why this is loved. If the DVT ultrasound is positive, then you would treat the DVT, which would obviously simultaneously treat any pulmonary embolism. If you were concerned about DVT, but that ultrasound was instead negative, the next step would be to order a dimer. If that dimer level is under 500, then no further evaluation for PE would be indicated. You're done. But if that dimer level were greater than 500, we unfortunately would need to move forward with a CTA. But What if we were concerned about PE, we get to that first step, and there are no signs or symptoms of DVT? So we can't use the DVT cheat code here. This is where we would order a dimer and proceed with the years criteria, which are nice because they've actually been prospectively validated at this point within this population. And there are a couple retrospective studies, I believe, afterwards that showed similar efficacy. So recall that the years algorithm, we mentioned it once already, uses three questions. We've actually already answered one of them, noting that there are no signs or symptoms of DVT. The only remaining questions would be, is there any hemoptysis, yes or no? And do we, as the providers, think PE is the most or equally likely diagnosis? If all of those are satisfied, we get to use that elevated dimer threshold of 1,000. If either of those remaining two questions were positive, that is to say concerning, we would use a dimer threshold of just 500. And in either case, a positive dimer, right, results in a CTA. And the authors do touch on, right, a common question. What about CTA versus VQ scan in this population? And as they summarize, right, ultimately the estimated fetal radiation exposure is minimal and safe from both scans. CTA does result in higher radiation exposure to breast tissue. Or I guess breast tissue is exposed to a higher radiation dose, but that dose ultimately has negligible implications on lifetime cancer risk. And CTA, as I think many of us know, is often preferred as it can help reveal alternative diagnoses, whereas the VQ scan really doesn't help us that much.
All right. Well, let's now finally jump into the title of this article, and that is management. So the authors jump right into the high risk group. And so why don't we start there, and then we'll go to the intermediate and then the low risk. When somebody is diagnosed with a PE and they are high risk, what is our therapy for these patients?
Yeah, the fun stuff here. So our high risk patients, aka those with hemodynamic instability, prompt aggressive treatment is necessary here. And the first or key thing that we're going to want to reach for is systemic thrombolytics in addition to systemic anticoagulation with heparin. So keep in mind, just to state it, the systemic anticoagulation with something like heparin, that prevents clot propagation. It prevents stuff from getting bigger. But in these patients, the clot burden is already too much. That is why they are hypotensive. That is why they're compromised. So we need to use those systemic thrombolytics to break it up. Now, there are a number of additional therapies that can potentially be offered, and the authors kind of briefly mentioned them, namely things like surgical embolectomy, catheter-directed treatments. These are not therapies that you or I in the ED are going to be offering in isolation, right? They come from specialists. These therapies usually are ideally are offered as part of a multidisciplinary group, often referred to as a PERT group or pulmonary embolism response team. So that would be the group to talk to when you have one of these patients and see what other therapies, in addition to our thrombolytics and systemic anticoagulation, we can offer.
All right. Well, next, the authors discuss the intermediate risk patients, formerly known as submassive, I guess. But now we're supposed to call them, as you said, intermediate risk, and further break them down into intermediate low risk and intermediate high risk. Can you take us through the differences there in terms of management?
Yes, and this is why, while that distinction may seem subtle, is actually important. For the intermediate low risk patients, they may only need oral anticoagulation, although I admit I personally would have a low threshold to put them on low molecular weight heparin, especially if they had any worrisome clinical factors. But for our intermediate high risk patients, this is where things get a little more interesting and admittedly controversial. So systemic anticoagulation with heparin, no brainer. Definitely going to do that for these patients. There has been a lot of debate over the years regarding the use of systemic thrombolytics in this population. And the authors appropriately note and kind of summarize that current guidelines only recommend thrombolytics for patients with intermediate risk PE who deteriorate despite the systemic anticoagulation. Catheter-directed therapies, however, are a very interesting option for these intermediate high-risk patients, and again reflects why it is important to make this distinction. So most of the existing data, the trials that exist out there in these CDT, catheter-directed therapies, are observational. But there have been a couple recent meta-analyses that have shown some pretty promising and encouraging results. And there are several ongoing RCTs that should finish within the next few years looking specifically at this. So an important potential therapy that hopefully we'll have some even more evidence for in the near future.
All right, excellent. And finally, let's move on to the low-risk patients. And I'm presuming that we're going to anticoagulate them with what is my first question? And then also there's been a lot more about disposition for these patients. So can you take us through those two questions?
Yeah, a good chunk of patients will ultimately have a low-risk pulmonary embolism, right? They don't have any hemodynamic instability. They don't have that RV dysfunction. They don't have an elevated troponin. And so these are patients who, you know, potentially could be treated with heparin or maybe even just ideally oral anticoagulation. But the next, and as you kind of hinted, bigger question becomes what to do with these patients? Where do they go? And historically, the answer to that question was pretty easy. You just admitted everyone who had a PE. But more recent data has shown that a decent proportion of patients can be managed safely and effectively in the outpatient environment. And I admit, at least personally, it feels like I'm seeing an increasing push both from professional society guidelines and even ABEM to make this a reality. Now, if that makes you feel uneasy, you are not alone. Dr. Westerfer, the lead author for this article, had another nice article published in Annals of Emergency Medicine last year as well, specifically investigating physician hesitancy towards discharging patients with acute PE. Fortunately, there are some things we can use to make us more comfortable with this, including a number of risk stratification tools. Again, that term risk stratification coming up again and again. These include the Pulmonary Embolism Severity Index, abbreviated PESI, and the somewhat more approachable called Simplified PESI, abbreviated SPESI. Important to note that both of these are designed to look at things like 30 and 90 day mortality, which, while undoubtedly important, do not encompass all factors that go into a decision of discharge versus hospitalization. And the authors of this paper appropriately emphasize what are called the HESTIA criteria, which were specifically created to identify patients who can be safely treated as outpatients, and includes considerations of things like comorbidities and psychosocial factors. So the overall pathway for discharging someone to get to that point would be, number one, make sure they're hemodynamically stable. Number two, make sure there are no signs of intermediate risk PE, such as RV strain or elevated troponin. Number three, make sure there are no high-risk features on the CTA, such as saddle embolus or clot visualized in the heart, right? Clot in transit. Number four, make sure there are no high-risk features on the ECG, such as new right heart strain pattern or new atrial fibrillation or flutter. Those atrial tachydesmias are a bad sign. And number five, make sure that none of the HESTIA criteria are present, which includes things like risk of bleeding, hypoxia, severe, like unrelenting pain, medical or social challenges, renal dysfunction, pregnancy, etc. And if you have all of those, out the door, hopefully we can go.
Excellent. And thank you so much for bringing up the EKG.
Of course.
All right. The nihilists out there for years have talked about this concept that some patients with PEs don't even need treatment if the PEs are really small. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I certainly have thoughts. There are a couple of guidelines that for select patients, right, these subsegmental PEs, instead recommend close observation. Again, so this is for a patient with a subsegmental pulmonary embolism, and additionally, they've had an ultrasound that shows they don't have a DVT. And instead of anticoagulation, these patients would receive something called structured surveillance, in which they have rapid follow-up, they get another DVT ultrasound in a week, and they, of course, have no issues seeing a primary care provider within 1 week either, which, while I don't want to speak for your own clinical interactions, Amal, I would say that I sadly find that a bit ambitious, even with all the resources we have allowed to us. So I am personally not big on this idea. I totally understand the impetus. Undoubtedly, some of the sub-segmental PEs are false positives. But just last year, there was a really great study in academic emergency medicine. It was one of my favorites from the year. And it looked at about 15,000 patients from Northern California. It was some Kaiser data that had been diagnosed with a PE. And when they went through all of those, they found that of that 15,000, only a few dozen met the full criteria for structured surveillance, of which only one patient actually received it. And I'll be honest, my takeaway from that was that under the current guidelines, the odds of me seeing two, if not even just one patient during my entire clinical career that meets these criteria and I'm going to feel comfortable with is so low that I just don't even see myself trying to pursue it.
Yeah, fair enough. And I guess maybe the thought about discharging these patients without treatment is based on what you alluded to, that the sub-segmental PEs are false positive readings. But, you know, other people have said that, you know, well, maybe the purpose of the lungs is to filter out PEs. So maybe it's normal for that. I'm not real comfortable with that. You know, I mean, it may be true and it filters out PEs. But again, I think it's important for people to remember that the reason that we anticoagulate patients is not because of the PE that they have right now, but because of the concern for the next PE. I mean, they've already proven themselves to survive the PE that they've got right now. So the whole therapy is based on preventing the next PE. So, you know, if somebody has a tiny PE, and let's say it's not a false positive, but if somebody has a tiny PE, I don't really care about that PE. I'm putting them on treatment because I'm worried that they're going to throw another big one. So
an excellent point.
Yeah, no one's. I've never heard anyone actually address that point before. I've always wanted to say that to the people, but usually
it's said here now. So
yeah, there we go. Usually, the people that are making the argument to not treat PEs are on podcasts or videocasts or whatever. So I can't really talk to them, but that's my concern. Anyway, David, that was a really, really helpful discussion of a very nice paper, and I appreciate that you brought in some outside thoughts also. Do you have any final take-home points or pearls for the listeners you want to leave them with?
Oh, always. First, I do want to underscore that this is a really great read. It is comprehensive without being overwhelming, and in my personal humble opinion, really should be required reading for anyone practicing in the emergency department. I don't think I've said that of any article we've reviewed thus far on this podcast. I really think this is great stuff. A few additional thoughts or points of emphasis that we kind of covered. Number one, if you are not using risk stratification tools while working patients up for PE, it's time to change your practice, right? I know these people myself, right? Presence of an IV alone is not indication for a CTA. We need to be thinking a little more strategically about that. Number two, I know it's hard, but try and strike those terms massive and submassive from your vocabulary. You know, make sure you're familiar with the criteria for intermediate low versus intermediate high versus high risk when it comes to mortality in PE patients. This is going to be important when discussing these patients with our surgical and interventional colleagues. We want to show that we know what we're talking about. Number three, building off of that, if your site does not have a PERT team, either in-house or associated with it, you know, just make sure you kind of know where one can be reached, right? Our central medical center kind of serves as that PERT location and service for all of the hospitals in our system. Hopefully you have one that you're aware of so that when you do have this patient, you know who to reach out to without delay. Number four, when it does come to treatment, a couple of things that, unless I missed it, I don't think the authors really touched on. One thing is consider starting presumptive anticoagulation on patients who might have a high risk, right, severe PE, even before you've made that diagnosis. The authors also didn't discuss some of these other adjunctive treatments like vasopressors and inhaled pulmonary vasodilators. And I think that's fair because the data on that stuff is pretty poor. One pitfall that I do think is important to always mention is when you do see that patient who has a PE and they're hypotensive or tachycardic, right? Our brains automatically go, ooh, quick, let's hang a couple liters of saline. This can be detrimental because it only further distends the right side of the heart. So if your patient is clearly hypovolemic, you know, certainly you consider giving judicious doses of fluid sequentially and reassessing, but giving a patient who's not hypovolemic a bunch of fluid is not going to make the situation better, and it may make it worse. And finally, one final thought on the treatment aspect, in terms of another modality that the authors did not discuss is ECMO. Obviously, not all sites have ECMO, and not all institutions even believe in ECMO for PE patients. But having seen it save lives at our own institution, I consider myself a convert. And, you know, we'll sometimes do what we call is place high-risk patients on a so-called ECMO watch, where they might even get micropunctures so that as they're being observed in the IMC or wherever else, if they do decompensate, they can be cannulated, you know, almost instantly in those situations. And finally, point number five, I think we are all going to increasingly see a push to discharge low-risk PE patients. You know, my personal opinion, this is not something that I think any of us or even myself are going to feel comfortable doing independently, and really should be organized at a departmental, if not hospital level, as we want to make sure issues like insurance coverage of some of these expensive medications like DOACs and guaranteed follow-up are not issues for our patients. So medical directors and department chairs and hospital administrators should really take the lead on making that possible.
Great, great points. Appreciate that you went a little bit beyond the paper with some of those management issues regarding the really, really sick patients, and also avoiding IV fluids, which is a mistake that I've made and I'm sure other people have made also. So, David, thanks so much for taking us through this topic and this really nice article. You mentioned that this is probably a must-read article. I would agree with that. I don't remember you saying anything was a must-read article, although I'll throw one other must-read article in for emergency medicine. A few years ago, there was, I think in EM clinics, there was something about evaluation of the renal transplant recipient. I think that was a must-read article also. So,
that's a must-cite article. That's what it really needs is some citations to bump its H-index up.
So, but anyway, thanks so much for taking us through this article, and I hope to get you back on EMCast in the near future.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, folks, well, it's time to do a little summary of what I think was a really fun discussion. Two great topics. These are the kind of things that we live for. We went into emergency medicine because we like taking care of sick patients, and this month's EMCast was all about some really, really sick patients. So we started out with a discussion of some focused updates in ACLS that was published by the AHA in Circulation. Mike Winters and Lloyd Tannenbaum were our guest speakers. And just to really quickly summarize the latest updates, once again, epinephrine remains a class one recommendation in cardiac arrest, whether you like epi or not. I know there's still a lot of controversy. They still list it as a class one. Now, most importantly, for non-shockable rhythms, it's really important to get epi on board as soon as possible. That seems to have the best evidence. And for shockable rhythms, the most important thing to do is to shock the patient. Epinephrine may have questionable benefit in the shockable rhythms, so the most important thing you can do is defibrillate as quickly as possible, or if they have a pulse, you want to cardiovert those unstable patients as quickly as possible. Other drugs have variable levels of evidence. Vasopressin, class 2B. Methylprednisolone has class 2B, and I think that's a little bit generous anyway. There's really not a whole lot of data on the steroid issue. Anyway, non-vasopressor therapies, for example, antiarrhythmics, are all class 2B at best. Lidocaine, amiodarone 2B, steroids class 2B. Calcium and sodium bicarbonate have some really important utility in certain specific situations. Calcium if they're hyperkalemic, sodium bicarb if you're running into hyperkalemia or potential drug overdoses. But for routine use, they are listed as class 3, no benefit, possibly harmful. So I know that still is commonly used, but we probably ought to try to avoid giving those medications just as a routine. ECPR, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECPR is just easier to say. ECPR, which is all the rage now in certain centers that can do it, has a class 2A recommendation. We'll see how some more literature pans out. But again, one of the key things that they talk about in this article, which is really important, is that it really does utilize a lot of resources. And you have to have a very, very good hospital and emergency department setup to do this efficiently. Because as we mentioned, if you're doing ECPR, the rest of the emergency department almost entirely shuts down unless you have a very efficient process and can be doing ECPR in one patient while still concurrently and efficiently running the rest of the department. You don't want to ignore all the rest of the patients there. So it's not for everybody. It's not for every department out there. There's no standard criteria or consensus on which patients qualify for the ECPR, which is a little bit frustrating. Oftentimes, the people that are doing ECPR or make the decision about it seem to make their decision in what may appear to be kind of a random fashion. But again, part of that is because there's no standard criteria that have been set up nationally. In general, the patients that you think are going to do better tend to do better. Younger patients, patients with a lack of significant comorbidities, patients with a fairly good neurologic status prior to the cardiac arrest, patients that have a witness arrest with bystander CPR that's initiated pretty quickly, patients with the short transport and cannulation time, and patients that have an initial shockable rhythm, those tend to do best with the ECPR. But, you know, those tend to do best with non-ECPR interventions also, and maybe the ECPR just improves their outcomes a little bit further. Anyway, we'll see how further literature on this topic pans out, because there's a lot of studies that are going on with ECPR. Post-arrest cardiac cath has been a source of confusion and controversy in recent years, and with the few recent randomized studies, the AHA has clarified their stance. Essentially, if the patient has post-arrest return of spontaneous circulation and you get that initial EKG and there's ST segment elevation, or if there's persistent electrical instability or persistent evidence of significant myocardial damage or ongoing ischemia, those tend to be the patients in whom AHA is recommending strong consideration for early or immediate post-arrest cath. But on the other hand, if post-arrest the patient has no evidence of ST elevation in contiguous leads, in other words, traditional STEMI criteria, and they don't have electrical instability or any of those other things I mentioned, then those patients are probably best deferred on immediate cath and just focus on initial stabilization and resuscitation. And then after their admission, in the next couple of days, they can be reevaluated for whether they need to go for cath. But immediate cath mainly, we're focusing on ST segment elevation. Post-arrest temperature control is still recommended by AHA, but what temperature should you be shooting for? Well, it can be anywhere from 33 up to 37.5 degrees Celsius. So we still want to control their temperature. Cooling is a very good way of controlling their temperature, but most importantly, we don't want to let them become febrile, and that might be the main benefit of cooling them. By cooling these patients, we avoid the post-arrest fever that oftentimes can develop. Fever is associated with the worst outcome, and so you want to control their temperature, cool them for at least 24 hours before you start warming them up. And then the last topic was post-arrest seizure, which is really not something that I ever thought about before. But in those patients that have persistent comatose state when you get the pulses back, they may be having subclinical seizures. And so AHA is recommending, with a class 1 recommendation, to try to get an EEG in patients that remain comatose, because apparently anywhere from 10 to 35% of post-arrest patients that are persistently comatose may be having subclinical seizures, and that's something that we should treat. We want to treat the seizures. There is no current indication for prophylaxis of seizures. So if they have evidence of seizure activity, either overtly or on EEG, then we want to treat them, but no prophylactic antiepileptics for now. So that was it for the AHA updates. And we switch over to a really nice paper from Annals of Emergency Medicine that focused on pulmonary embolism. And one of my colleagues, Dr. David Gatz, took us through that paper. We want to start out with risk stratification as the first step. And how do we risk stratify these patients? Well, it can be based on Gestalt, or it can be based on the Well score, or it can be based on the revised Geneva criteria. Those are the three best and most recommended options. Now, clinical Gestalt can always be questioned if you're wrong. And also, there's problems using Gestalt, because whose Gestalt are you using? Is it somebody who's right out of residency, or is it somebody who has a ton of experience at evaluating patients with PE? So although the literature says Gestalt is pretty good, it really can vary in terms of how good the gestalt is. I'm tired of saying gestalt, so let's get away from that. The other two options are the Wells criteria and the revised Geneva criteria. We mentioned that here in our university system, throughout our hospital network, there's about, 10 to 15 hospitals in the network, we prefer using the revised Geneva criteria. That's a little bit more popular in Europe than in the United States, but it's worth getting familiar with the revised Geneva criteria. I love the Geneva criteria because it's all objective. The Wells criteria has a lot of evidence, but there's that pesky subjective question that you add to the Wells criteria whereby you're supposed to decide, is PE the most likely diagnosis? Well, once again, we're getting gestalt back in there, and if you're wrong, people will always question you about that particular part of the Wells criteria. So we like using the Geneva criteria because it's very objective. It's going to have a much, 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 much better inter-observer agreement. And also, if you work in a place where there's people of all different levels of experience and training, it's kind of nice to have a very objective set of criteria. So anyway, that's what you're going to use, gestalt, Wells, or the revised Geneva criteria. And based on those, whichever you use, again, we use revised Geneva, but based on those, you're going to risk stratify the patient into either low, intermediate, or high risk. If they're a high risk, you're done. You go right to imaging. Go right to the CT angiogram or VQ. If they're intermediate risk, you send off a D-dimer. And if the D-dimer is positive, you move over to imaging. If the D-dimer is negative, then you're done. And if on your initial risk stratification they come out low risk, then you use the PERC score. And if the PERC's positive, you do D-dimer. If the PERC is negative, then you're done. One important point here is that you never use the PERC score as your initial step. The PERC score is only intended to be used after the first step. PERC score is the second step. What is the first step? It's deciding on risk stratification. So you use the PERC score after you've done initial risk stratification and you've decided that they're low risk based on the risk stratification. And so low risk stratification plus negative PERC, then you're done. But if you use PERC score without doing any other risk stratification first, you might actually be missing, 5, 6, 7, perhaps as much as 8% of PEs will be PERC negative. And that's why you don't do the PERC score as your first step. That's your second step. It's a very important thing about the PERC score that we didn't really go into detail, but it's very important to remember. PERC score comes as a second step, not a first step. And that's how you decide whether you're going to get the pulmonary angiogram or not. Now, if you do have a confirmed PE, you want to do mortality risk stratification. And this is a little bit new. It used to be that we decide whether somebody has a massive PE, submassive, or I guess non-massive. And now things have changed just a little bit. What we're doing is we're putting them into one of three risk categories, either low mortality risk, high mortality risk, or intermediate mortality risk. And intermediate is broken down into intermediate low and intermediate high. And that is used to decide on treatment for these patients. Real quickly, if somebody is high risk, that's when you're considering thrombolytics or embolectomy. If somebody's low risk, those are the patients that you would strongly nowadays think about discharge home for outpatient therapy. And probably the best criteria to use to decide whether somebody qualifies for outpatient therapy is the Hestia criteria. So get familiar with the Hestia criteria. And then the intermediate group, that becomes just a little bit more complicated. But if they're intermediate low, you're just going with your anticoagulants. And if they're intermediate high risk, then again, you're going to monitor them very closely. And if they are doing poorly, then you might be considering thrombolytics again for those patients. I'm really summarizing things. Listen to the podcast, read the article for further details. Also, the other key thing from this article that they want you to know is that the non-Coumadin oral anticoagulants are very much accepted now. They seem to be easier for patients to take and provide a more consistent level of anticoagulation than the traditional warfarin did. So again, a lot more detail in the podcast and also in the article. It's a great article if you can get access to it, but the podcast, I think, really covers the major points that you need to know. All right, folks. Well, that does it for our summary of the March 2024 EMcast. Once again, don't forget to check out the websites for the upcoming Beats and Bones course and also the upcoming Cardiology Symposium. I hope everyone is having a really great start to your spring, and I guess it start to the fall season if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, and I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Until then, please take care.